You're listening to PorchDrinking.com's The Porchcast, brought to you by Molly's Spirits. And now, The Porchcast.
Alrighty, folks. Well, welcome to episode 71 of The Porchcast. I am very thrilled to be joined by my co-hosts, Sammy Hartman, Corey David, and our engineer, Bryant Vanderweerd. I'm Tristan Chan. And we're also thrilled to be joined today by Alex Kidd. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got it. It's
four letters, two repeaters. It's a toughie.
Yeah, sorry, guys. Alex Kidd of Don't Drink Beer. We're very pumped to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been a little bit since we last recorded, but we're in the midst of Oktoberfest, Fresh Hop, and GABF season. We're going to touch on some of those in just a bit. But first and foremost, Alex, you're a lawyer, B, you started the very popular satirical beer outlet, Don't Drink Beers. You've gone on to launch Malt Couture, a podcast of your own. You're a man of many talents. Tell us how this all got started.
Sure. So the Don't Drink Beer was the product of a merger of two of my other pre-existing interests. I was doing stand-up and improv back in like 2010, taking improv classes at UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, and I was doing homebrewing and stuff. And ultimately, I started writing these reviews that were like non-standard. They were like a merger of kind of the comedy world and, you know, trying to be funny, but also like impart a degree of knowledge about beer. And so I got kicked off Beer Advocate for writing those types of reviews. So I bought my own domain name and, happy accident. Thanks to Jason and Todd for putting me on this path for the past decade.
Yep. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned, your beer reviews, I think that's one of the things that I actually was drawn to the most about when I first started getting into following your stuff. I feel like you compose those beer reviews reading like a very comedic poetry kind of essence, and you're able to break down these aspects of beer into hilarious parallels that most people wouldn't ever even be able to dream of. And so I guess, how much time do you actually spend when it comes to tasting the beer, digesting it, and then kind of putting those words into play and into action after, you know, getting sent samples upon samples of beers?
Well, I drink a lot of beer, and so I kind of have to integrate that.
Yeah, that's all you need. That's all you need.
That aspect I have to integrate into doing like other stuff, you know, like hanging out with my wife or doing other things. And so it's like, I'll write down notes and I'll have a concept of what I want to say about it. And I'll kind of just let it germinate and I'll come back to it like either in a few hours or the next day. And depending on how involved the review is, sometimes it's something that's just right over the plate. It's, you know, if it's Two Row and Citra and a California ale strain, I'm not going to have to like reinvent the wheel to review it. But then there's some things that are like culturally relevant to beer. And then I'll have to like, you know, like dig deep and come up with a, you know, 700 words that express something that's like the gestalt or the, you know, that like what's going on in beer itself that makes this particular thing relevant.
So absolutely. I think what's cool too is that even when there are aspects of a beer, I don't think it's very rare that I see that you completely just trash a beer, but even with really, really great beer, I think you provide such valuable feedback that even, you know, even if it is a negative aspect of the beer, I've heard from brewers oftentimes who take so much valuable feedback from what you put forth and they really take it to heart. So I think that's been a super essential element to helping brewers improve their craft.
Alex, do you have any favorite adjectives that you like to use that are funny or also very descriptive?
There's some that that people have dog-eared, and so I like don't even use them anymore. I won't use the word svelte, diaphanous. There's like a few that like people nimble. I can't use the word nimble anymore. Apparently use that too much. But there's certainly like a host of words that I think really nail what the beer is doing, but not like so far as to go into like that pretentious wine, completely abstracted adjectives where things are, direct and forthright and demure, you know, like where you're like, what are you talking about? This is like a Pinot Noir.
I feel like you could probably replace some of the beer names with like famous people in history and see if people would just be like, oh yeah, I get that. You know, just like do like an ad lib kind of, or mad lib kind of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Ooh.
This, yeah. This, I find this stout to be Kafka-esque, really. I don't.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I, what along that line, you know, you're talking about these kind of words that have kind of been vetoed and put on hold. I think one of the cool things about Don't Drink Beer is that there's become this kind of cult following fanaticism around it. And I think what's ironic about what you all do is that it feels like you all started out kind of poking fun at the same group that has kind of embraced you all so wholly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the beer trading culture. It's people who love hype beers, hype breweries. How have you seen this subsect of craft beer evolve since when you first launched Don't Drink Beers to where you are now?
Well, a few things have changed. Like first and foremost, a lot of the people that I came up with in the early 2010s are now like, those are like brewery owners. So like on one aspect, you have the people that were destined to become producers that weren't like so emphasized on like being consumers. And in terms of the consumer market's changed such that like the entire scope of parity has to be altered. Like things that used to be like a joke in, you know, 2014, are just de rigueur. That's just like our reality now. And so it's like, you have to amp up the dial and really be like more focused in your commentary. Like I would say like the laziest beer levity would be like something that's like a screenshot and then noting that people add cereal to beer. Anybody can make that. That's not high art. And it's not really a pointed commentary on what's actually happening. Like if you go up Maslow's pyramid of like funnier things, it's going to be more pointed things about like the nature of the beer's consumer's psychology, their insecurities, and why people are making cereal beers, and like what type of person, what void are they filling in their life? Those are the best jokes because those are the ones that people go, fuck, that is me, ouch, and haha.
Speaking of which, what's your favorite breakfast cereal?
Yeah, I don't know if they make it anymore because apparently breakfast cereals have fallen off a cliff in terms of sales. We live in a carbophobic world now, but I used to love Golden Grahams, and I feel like that's a dark horse.
They still make them for sure.
Well, and they re-released the new recipe, or well, the throwback recipe, but this year you can get like the old like honey recipe or whatever.
Oh, that was more gold.
Made with gold.
Add that into a blonde barley wine, and I think we're on to something, team. I think we've got something good.
I think that's hilarious because I've seen that happen so much recently where like Cheetos is like the original Cheetos recipe, right. Or like Coca-Cola, and like you're like, wait, what the fuck have I been eating and drinking this entire time? Like
no, I actually hope that the original Coca-Cola recipe had cocaine in it. So I don't know. How close are we actually coming to that? Because I could either be a huge fan or I shouldn't have this at all.
Yeah, well, it's 2020. We definitely
fail a drug test.
Yeah, yeah. Steve and I, the co-host of the other podcast that I do, Rotating Tap, we keep trying to convince people to let us make a line of Doritos flavored seltzers, and we haven't had a biter yet. But we're really hoping we can get a mixed 4-pack together sometime next year.
Yeah,
and the limit does not exist. You can make a seltzer flavor out of anything.
Yeah, why not Doritos?
Now, I want to take a quick break because we kind of jumped right into it, but I do want to thank two of our sponsors for the show. First and foremost, Molly's Spirits, a land of adult beverage discovery, offering a curated selection of beers, wines, and spirits in Lakeside and Greenwood Village, Colorado. Shop over 14,000 products, including exclusive collabs and an extensive craft beer selection, in-store or online for curbside pickup or delivery. Learn more at mollyspirits.com. Also, we have a new sponsor for the show just for this month. A big thank you to Cerebral Brewing. If 2020 were like any other year, we'd be revving up for all the hops, Cerebral's GABF Parking Lot Can Jam Extravaganza, where they bring some of the country's best breweries to Denver for all to enjoy. But this year isn't like any other. No GABF, no travel, no fun. Hell no. This year, they're introducing all the stops, a vicarious voyage across the nation with stops, some of our favorite breweries. Last week was actually the first iteration of this where they partnered with a bunch of California breweries. And this week they've actually brought on Parrish Brewing and Southern Tier. So be sure to check out Cerebral Brewing. Their actual release takes place tomorrow. And you can pick that up on Friday. So each week they essentially have rotating a different rotating case of beers from rare breweries all across the country that you can't typically get in Colorado. It's a pretty rad deal that they put together, and you can find those at cerebralbrewing.com.
And for those of us listening to the podcast, it will already be out. You said tomorrow. Tomorrow, according to the live stream, which we are streaming on October 13th. But podcast listeners, you know, head there now. They got it right now.
Yeah. Thanks for that correction.
Run, don't walk.
By the way, Vicarious Voyage sounds like the Kidz Bop version of Fantastic Voyage, does it not? That sounds a little too innocent.
Absolutely. Now, we're talking about kind of like this fanboy kind of subsect of craft beer. Do you, and you also mentioned a little bit about kind of how in today's world, this the hierarchy of what's actually funny. Do you feel like the craft beer scene has gotten at all too serious about itself? And are there instances where, you know, I think you already mentioned it, like pouring cereal into beer, where, you know, these hilarious kind of memes and jokes that emerged probably 5-10 years ago have now become the norm. Where do you see that heading for the future of craft beer?
I think that the brewers themselves, obviously, they're aware of the jokes. And so by virtue of marketing, they're going to try and stay ahead of the references themselves, because if you lampoon your own content like straight out the gates, it takes a lot of the sting out from what you're actually producing. Now, in terms of like what people are actually drinking, that's really the tail wagging the dog that's causing these people to create these things. I think that media awareness of what they are putting in the mash tun is, you know, it's a lever that's being pulled as a result of being, you know, 8,300 different breweries deep, every one of them carrying debt and needing to drum up goodwill as fast as possible to get that dedicated fan base. And so we'll definitely see more of it, and we'll see things that, you know, maybe push the limits beyond what we've already seen, because the gamesmanship has to increase. Like, when a cereal beer becomes passe, then it's like, then what? Like animal protein? Then, you know, like whatever the next version of it is. I mean, like, if you need any indication, look at how ridiculous and circumstantial the bourbon world is. Every single cask has to have some Japanese RPG backstory to it to generate some sales, like from Tornado Block C to Jefferson's Ocean to it's all like nonsense, because at the end of the day, they're peddling corn water and we're pushing out malt water. You know, like, yeah. So it's going to get worse for sure.
Do you feel like you mentioned kind of the bourbon world? I see many parallels there. Has the ridiculousness of craft beer pushed you at all more towards spirits at all? Or are you still just as excited about beer, but just in a different capacity?
Oh, I'm not excited about the spirits world at all. That is like, it's so fully commodified. If you only have to go hit the boards and try and like cut some deals, and you just see, it's like, it's dudes in their like mid 50s where, you know, wearing like Titleist polo shirts, and they have like Dodge Chargers, and like, they're just like, this is what it costs. No, it sold for $10 less than that. Like, they're squabbling over, you know, $1,000 bottles for 10 bucks. Who's going to pay for the label? There's no community to it. There's no, like, there's far less shares. There's far less like collaborative. It is literally just like brown water stocks that are traded with no intention of ever opening or sharing. In terms of the community, you can make some money profiting off of people who don't have the access, but there's no reason to be like, to wax philosophical and be like, ah, yeah, bourbon, that's a fun, what a fun boards to engage on.
Yeah. And similarly, there is like that high trade value, trade market, if you will, like in the spirits world, particularly with whiskey. But I think your sales ceiling is like way higher there, because you can hang on to it for forever, you know, and then actually will only appreciate in value, as opposed to some beers where you're like, all right, this might be worth a lot, but it's really only worth a lot for like a month at the most. So you don't have that like same parallel, but the trading market is one that I've never really, I can't stand it. I mock it all the time, especially because it's usually over stuff that nowadays I'm old man yelling at the sky on the front lawn. Just like, people are in line for this, people are trading for this. And now you have proxies, people that are waiting in line to not consume any of the beer. They just want to be able to sell it back to somebody else for like double the cost. I'm like, what the fuck kind of world are we living in?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, we're still seeing that in the beer world, but I feel like it's a, a far smaller percentage of people. And I feel like even in recent kind of maybe years, it's kind of toned down a little bit just due to kind of Facebook crackdowns and different, you know, pushing people to the fringes in of the internet and having to find their own little kind of niche groups.
Yeah, Antifa, lots of beer trading going on there.
Absolutely.
Proud Boys and Antifa, big beer traders.
Big time.
That's what they've been warning about during all these debates that I've been missing.
It's about the fringe.
Speaking of kind of current events, you know, back in June, Alex, one of the things that I was super, like, extremely impressed with was kind of your response to, you know, a couple of instances that really have really bubbled up into a greater awareness around police brutality and systemic racism. You launched a fundraiser to benefit the families of Breonna Taylor and subsequently Elijah McClain. And you know, what you were able to accomplish has turned a lot of heads in the craft beer world. In just under a week, you had 14,000 participants who raised over $67,000. I don't remember what the final count was, but how did this concept come about, and kind of where did you all end up with the fundraising efforts?
Well, first and foremost, shout out to Beer Snobbin, who taught me how to do it, because that guy has been raising money for good causes all over. So he showed me how to do it. And really what I noticed is there's a lot of breweries that perhaps share the same sentiment, but because we exist in the marketplace where you cannot wear your political badge on your sleeve, you get dragged, you end up on Worst Beer Blog, your comment section is a dumpster fire instantly, because beer is a drink for everyone. That means every perspective is going to show up. Everyone enjoys hazy IPAs, regardless of what their life brings them to. And for that reason, I think people go to beer to escape that sort of thing. And so what I realized was I am not subject to those types of like comments or customer decisions. Like, you can cancel Don't Drink Beer, but it's not like, I'm just a lawyer. You know, like I'm like, it, like it's, so what I realized was, like, if the breweries can't say it, they can launder their position through me. So I'll take the brunt of it. Like, I will organize the fundraiser. They can contribute if they'd like to. But ultimately, the crux falls on me. And it's really a testament to the actual community and the actual unification of, like, all of these breweries, because I didn't go out with the alms cup, like, shaking people down, which is, like, the biggest cliche, like, hitting breweries up for charity bottles or to do this. They all, like, almost every single one of those breweries came to me. It got to the point where we had so many breweries that wanted to participate. We couldn't sell enough slots. My Gmail got shut down because I had sent too many emails. We had to put a cap on it. Like, we ended up giving out something like 76 boxes, like, to different people. Yeah. So it really was demonstrative of where these breweries' hearts and minds are really at. And I don't think that it was like the classic virtue signaling from these breweries, because what would they get out of it? They're sending me a box, like, almost anonymously, just to show their support of extremely expensive, extremely valuable beer. Some of them, like breweries like Brad Clark's Private Press, like, he hasn't even
launched yet.
Yeah. It's like, if you talk about somebody who's not in a position to be doling out hundreds and hundreds of dollars, like, those are the types of people that get involved. And so that's really, like, the fact that we raised $67,000 is amazing. Yeah. That's the cool part on the front end. But I think the cooler part on the back end was seeing, like, air quotes, just normal people. They would look in their cellars, they would grab, you know, I know this is worth $300 or this, and this, and they would put together four bottles and they would do a tiny, like, their own tiny raffle. And, like, that's cool. Cause, like, they're the exact same as me. I'm just the guy with the WordPress account. They're just a person with an Instagram, you know, like, that's the cool change. Because if that keeps showing up, ultimately, like, you put people on their back foot if they're like, if they feel like they can't speak out against something, like, they'll be more likely to, or if they're going to say something that perhaps in the past went unchecked, then it puts them in a position where it's like, well, I don't know. A lot of these breweries nobody seems to agree with me, you know, like, mm-hmm. it might kind of change the pH of the narrative in craft beer, at least.
Did you happen to see any instances of that actually relayed to you where, mm-hmm. you know, someone, or maybe you receive some negative feedback. I'm sure at least somebody
reached out.
Yeah, I feel like half of your day has to be handling negative feedback.
Yeah, just pushback.
Big time. And to be honest, I had to learn along the way about my own failings. I have the book White Fragility. I'm familiar with the concept of it, but I got called out for leveraging alcohol brands and that it wasn't focused enough on Breonna Taylor. And for me, I was being ignorant. My defenses went up and I was like, what are you talking about? I'm doing so much. And then you have to recalibrate. You have to constantly check yourself and say, how much of this is just talking about a raffle? And then I had to change the mixture and be like, every third post now is going to be the facts of it. What a no-knock warrant is, what a cartoid chokehold is, so that you're not only pushing what the raffle is, but I learned along the way as a result of the criticism. And then there's some stuff where it's just you're gonna court that, and it's fine. That's why I'm saying breweries can launder their viewpoints through me so that they don't have to deal with it and it doesn't affect their bottom line. I'll take it. They don't have to.
Didn't you also get a lot of flack for promoting a book on social media?
Oh, God. Yeah.
I just saw PTSD in your eyes. I just saw
that was, I knew things were going to be bad. But that was
because you kind of said what you're getting into a little bit. Can you explain what the book was and why it might be controversial?
Yeah. So the book is called Beer and Racism. And it was a book that hadn't even come out yet. Nobody's read this. And I posted the abstract where you could buy the book. And essentially it is a top-down approach about the historical implications of white dominance in craft beer culture from, all the way back into pre-prohibition days, where you could drink, who could drink, who the targeted consumers were, and then all the way the through line on production and then modern day, who currently owns all the breweries, who participates, who are the consumers, and why, why is this, why is that the nature of the current marketplace? And I knew that I was going to take heat. So I intentionally took a super cordial stance, offered to buy people free copies of the book if they would just read it. And it just became this mess of talking about critical race theory and it devolved in a much worse, disheartening way than I expected. But it was very telling because if you fall on the very tip of the spear of the type of what people's reactions are going to be, it's going to be hard, but you have those uncomfortable conversations and, the second conversation might be a little easier, the third, the fourth, the fifth, and maybe those people share that book on their timelines. And even if you totally disagree with it, you were able to articulate why, and then we're having clearer arguments that aren't just you're a Marxist or you're virtue signaling, you're race baiting. As long as they're better arguments and not just as incendiary, I think that alone is a better function.
Sure. Some people were probably just mad that they're racist, but they can't read, so they can't even learn about it if they want to.
That's gotta be tough.
If there's an audio book, I'm all about it, but this reading shit's for the birds.
Yeah.
Now, Alex, you mentioned earlier and multiple times that, breweries saw you as an opportunity to serve as a platform for some of these viewpoints that, might be harder to address on their own channels. Do you think that we've reached a point in society where breweries should feel more comfortable to being able to kind of wear their opinions on their sleeves? And we've talked on the show often about how, what breweries often utilize the line, we embrace our community, we're super active in our community and we want to support our community. It's always about community. But when it comes to a time like this, where, whether it's supporting Black Lives Matter or supporting the LGBTQ community, we've seen breweries kind of shy away and feel kind of an obligation to appease the masses versus actually taking a stand. I guess have you had any of those conversations through this fundraiser that you've put together where, breweries might feel a little bit more comfortable to actually share their viewpoints and actually take a stand in supporting marginalized communities that previously didn't have representation.
Yeah, I think certainly behind the scenes in emails and messages and things, like the breweries who participate essentially communicate, you're saying something that I wish I could say, which is basically just the positive version of what I previously would do with Don't Drink Beer, is criticize the industry in a way that other breweries cannot, except for this one actually leads to meaningful change and doesn't just, you know, like lead to like an easy punchline. In terms of like the prescriptive statement, should, like what should breweries do? I get it. Like it's tough to hold industrial facilities producing alcohol to some like incredibly high standard that we don't hold many other places, restaurants or things like that. So I get it. And they're running on razor thin margins. A lot of these places like do not need to alienate 41% of their potential customer base by going crazy political. But when you do things like second shift brewing and you put it out there, I will submit that goodwill is 70% of a brewery's value. And you stand, if you gamble and you do it correctly, like you will weed out the people that you don't want supporting your product anyway. But more importantly, forget the bottom line. You are changing an industry that perhaps has been lampooned and criticized as being overweight white men in their 30s with beards, you know, with disposable income. And I think subverting that trope and like making it seem like a place that more people belong and that is more inclusive and like the drink itself, that everyone can come to the table and have a pour of a grisette. Like that's the type of meaningful change that would be really cool to see, however we get there.
Absolutely. Well, again, I want to echo just how impressed I was with what you all ended up doing. Do you foresee any other opportunities of putting together fundraisers of this nature, or was that a little bit too much more than you could bite off of?
I learned a lot about how to structure it and ways that I can change it in the future. I don't think that hammering people again and asking for money, like, you know, still on the second wave of a pandemic when a lot of people haven't gone back to work, haven't received stimulus checks or anything like that, it's made me hesitant to really rattle the alms cup at people again. Yeah. And I think that coming back at it, doing a second pass, like one of the criticisms that I received is that I focus heavily on police brutality and race issues. And certainly there are like women's rights issues that I'd love to address. And there's certainly like aspects of the LGBTQ community that I would love to support. And like, I got to pick and choose and basically go all out when I can to make sure that it is addressing something, so that it's not just once a month, here's a small thing, like here's a gesture, here's a thing, you know, so that I can't really focus my attention on it. So the short answer is yes, we'll do it again. And it's gonna be a matter of timing and letting people know.
Awesome. Well, we'd love to be a part of that and help spread the great, great message that you guys put forward. So let us know how we can help to assist and get the word out.
Yeah.
Now, kind of going back to the origins of Don't Drink Beer, you know, part of, I think one of the things that I really love is following all these kind of inside jokes and memes that you all have created over the years. But how did the Barley Wine is Life movement how did that come about?
People increasingly left a lot of like the big box sites like Rate Beer and Beer Advocate and Talk Beer, and they were going and creating their own essentially boards on Facebook. And I noticed that there was like an insular group for every single style of beer. There was one for lagers and stouts and hazy IPAs and anything you want, and there wasn't one for barley wines, let alone old ales, Roggen beers, Adam beers, Stark beers, you know, like nothing in that ambit. And so just by a stroke of luck, I was drinking a lot of barley wines, and at 2 a.m. I made a group. And when you make a group, Facebook lets you invite 100 people, and the first 100 people I invited were all like old school, like old money, like people who would actually like barley wine. And fortunately, like inviting those first 100 people, they were all people that just like, it gave them a place to kind of open to this obscure style. And I think that honestly, the reason that it took off is just because they're filled with people who have a good knowledge about beer, care about it, have been in long enough to know what a barley wine is and to kind of embrace it. And secondly, they're all really smart, funny people, funnier than I am. And so it's just a good, fun place to exist because it creates its own culture and it creates its own memes about like Otters and Rolos and Werthers and, you know, like whatever else goes on in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And how much barley wine do you actually drink each month? Can you quantify that into an estimate?
Well, I mean, it's one of these like things like, you know, that movie Fantasia when Mickey's the Sorcerer's Apprentice and then the buckets come and they're just like keep dumping more. And then he chops the brooms in half and there's more brooms. Like that's what happens because everyone's like, oh, Alex is the barley wine guy. So every brewery will send me like their iteration of barley wine, which is amazing. But if I dump on a barley wine, then it creates like three more brooms. We're like, that's, well, ours is better. Like, and if you like say this one's the best, they're like, well, ours is better. And so you get more and more barley wine. And like at a certain point, calorically and like liver wise, you can only do so much. So what I do is I drink a lot of different barley wines, but I'll only drink like maybe, you know, 6 to 8 ounces of each thing. And just, I'll get the gist and move on. But I'm trying like probably like, I don't know, at least 3-4 different barley wines a week, just cause I have so many. Like, wow. Like right now I'm drinking an 8th state Pilsner, like just to kind of like warm up the rotator cuff because I can't like jump right into a lot of these barley wines. So it's a lot. It's several barley wines to answer that question.
If you're sitting on a lot of barley wine, what's the appropriate level of soy sauce for you after it's been sitting around for a while? And then when do you start using it on food?
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing. Quarantine has just been wasteful. Yeah, like the degree I can't have live shows where I would usually host like VIP bottle sessions and bring stuff that I'm excited to share. Malt Couture, my podcast, we have to do that remotely. And so like, we have to be a lot more direct and focused in what we're sharing. And just in terms of just social gatherings, like everybody has their beer friend who rolls up with like 6 750s of beer just because they want to try all of those, but they don't want to commit to any one of those. Like, it's like the brewery / rare barrel effect where they're sitting on all of these like member bottles that like none of them, they want to just take to themselves. Like that's kind of like my life. Like I have all these things I'm excited to try, but like, I also feel like a dick if I open a stout knowing that I'm like, I can only have like 8 to 10 ounces of this. Cause it's just too ambitious.
I think that makes you a hoarder now. I think that's how that works.
For sure.
I don't think intentionally, but I think you're a hoarder now.
I'm getting there.
Yeah. When do you go from Savant to TLC reality show?
Where it's got just the corridor to the bathroom and you have to stand on top of Crooked Stave boxes. Like those are from the early 2013s.
You can't take a step without just hearing rattling of bottles, yeah. Like reverberating throughout the house.
This is from when Chad homebrewed it himself and bottled everything. No, I've deal with the same problem mostly because, I also just don't drink a lot of beer during the week. And so I actually have a lot of beers that I just have holed up in every single room in our house. So whenever we have an opportunity to have bottle shares, that's when I bring everything out and try to share with all of our friends. So
humble brag, Tristan has restraint. Good for you, buddy.
Ooh, good for you.
You can control yourself.
You know, my body would actually murder me if I drink any more than I already do. So yeah.
Tristan's Alex, like, I have to put them in the guest closet. I hope they don't explode. God, to dry clean all those furs and Fendi sweaters? My word.
If you hear something bubbling from the closet, don't mind. It's my homebrew. That's
pay no attention.
Yeah, don't mind that.
Oh, I'm so good at the intake. It's like, yeah, give it to me. I would like it. Thank you. And then I'm like, I'll have one and none of the rest. Yeah. Why is my fridge all beer again?
Damn. Oh, yeah. The thing is, whenever we'd hang out with Sammy back in the day when she actually still worked for Cerebral, she would always roll in with a ton of cans and we'd just be like, God damn it. Like, this is happening.
Well, I guess we have to. Sorry. Yeah.
We might as well. Yeah. Sorry. I've gotten so many.
Time to stop inviting Sammy to the podcast.
Hey, Alex, with the Malt Couture and doing your live shows, like how did you guys have that set up? I mean, do you have breweries that you're just like really tight with in different parts of the country and you're just doing a straight like live recording of the podcast? Was there stand-up involved? Like, how'd you guys do that?
So the format of the show is pretty similar to what you hear. It's literally just live. It's like, if you've ever heard a podcast, like How Did This Get Made? They have like their studio versions and then they have their live versions. I do tweak the show to add, games and some things that have more, a little bit more audience participation. But one important aspect of the live shows is we have a VIP bottle share before every single show that like myself, Michael and Steven, like we'll guide bottles that we bring them in cases and cases of stuff on the plane with us. We take them to the venue and set it all up. So it's really like, every show is a one-off. It's not scalable. It's not replicable. Like every show that we agree to do is a huge, huge pain in the ass. And like, but in the best way, because you meet people that have like already given you, you know, all these hours while they're doing laundry and going grocery shopping. And so like you hit the ground running with people that like have this unilateral relationship with you. And honestly, it's one of the biggest things that I miss like from this entire year. And in terms of setting them up, it is a logistical nightmare, but it's like, I love doing it. We have to basically, breweries do not know anything about hosting comedy shows. Like 9 times out of 10, like they're literally just like that. We can put like 4 pallets over there. And I think one of the guys is in a band and he's got like, he's got a Behringer, like a little speaker you can talk into. Like, it's just, it's not like, we've done rock venues and stuff. But for the most part, if we're doing brewery shows, we bring our own PA, we bring all this beer, we write the entire show. And it's literally like a 2-hour long show that incorporates all kinds of stuff, improv, some like opening monologue type of stuff. And that's why we're only able to do like, you know, 10 a year. Like if I wasn't a lawyer and we had infinite time, I could do one every weekend. We'd go to a different place and it'd be amazing. It's just like, it's just not like the realities of my domestic life.
Absolutely.
Bougie.
I don't even have central AC. Let's calm down.
At what point do you transition? I mean, is this a thing where you can move to full time? I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but
yeah.
You know, I see a lot of parallels in one of my favorite inspirations in terms of starting porch drinking. There's a Kentucky Sports Radio website out in Kentucky where I'm from. And he actually, coincidentally enough, was a lawyer, started out as a lawyer and started this Kentucky sports blog and decided to go full time with it. Probably, I think, about 10 years ago. And so I see a lot of that in what you've created, this, you know, all these different media outlets and different, you know, avenues that you have to create some really, really killer content. And so do you ever foresee, you know, wanting to go full time into beer, or is your passion for, you know, law dogging it just as much?
I mean, it's a balancing act, because basically what you're talking about is scaling Don't Drink Beer and making it so accessible that I could create a fan base that would supplant a lawyer's income. and just like to give you an idea, not that a lawyer's income is so tremendous, it's that a comedian's income is so low that like that the valley is like crazy distant between them. Like, it'd be a dream. It'd be an absolute dream. But the problem is I cannot dilute the mixture enough to get to a level where like for Don't Drink Beer to be the Barstool Sports of beer, I would have to make some content that is so accessible that it is pandering to people who like don't eat, who are literally like drinking Trulies, and like they don't like, I'm not addressing that segment of the culture. And I think that I would have meaningfully changed. Imagine if like you take like middle class fancy and those types of like Instagram memes where it's like they're really broad, huge strike zone, they're addressed at people who drink Bud Light, and then you're trying to basically like you're trying to grist out live performances from that segment, because it's got to be like a, you know, you're knocking out a good amount of like anyone under 21 can't, like essentially can't enjoy sure. like your yeah. content, and then a lot of older people just like by nature of it aren't gonna be on board. So like what I'd rather do is create meaningful content that, you know, if it's not as profitable, like that's fine, but like I'd like to mean a lot to like a couple thousand people and just see where it takes me. I've already spent 10 years doing this like without dollar signs in my eyes, and I think yeah. that that is kind of like the best way to approach any form of artistry or any project, because you end up getting the best results because you're not beholden to likes or reshares or like how many TikTok followers. Like, I think the most organic engagement like ends up driving like the best results, and knock on wood, will continue to grow.
That's awesome. We very much prescribe to the same kind of approach at Porch Drinking, and you know, it really is about the love of the craft. And so we have so much respect for what you've created and what you continue to do.
Thanks.
Well, guys, I wanted to jump in real quick. One last thing, you know, this happens to be GABF week. While it may have gone to the virtual version of the event, I know one of the last times I got to see Alex in person was actually when they did their recording at Amalgam here last year. So Alex, you know, this is an interesting time for the Brewers Association. We talked a little bit about systemic racism, and one of the big things that they've been accused of is not fully addressing, you know, systemic racism and you know, disparities and you know, demographics and it's this weird kind of balance as well with the BA, because you know, they've had to lay off a significant portion of their staff and you know, their biggest revenue generators of the year have all been essentially wiped out in all of their major events. And so I guess, where do you see the role of the BA in terms of the beer industry? I find it interesting because I feel like you're a little bit of this kind of underground representation of craft beer in a sense, whereas the BA is very much an establishment and you know, not something that I'm sure they could have really changed in their developmental phase, but it is interesting that, you know, to me, someone as you know, grassroots and rebellious as Don't Drink Beer can drum up such a impactful fundraising effort, where, you know, we still have the CEO Bob Peace refusing to acknowledge one of the biggest incidents in craft beer in terms of racism, in the Founders incident. So I guess, where do you see this balance, and is there anything that you would recommend for the Brewers Association in terms of addressing some of these really, really high level issues?
Yeah, I think it's extremely tough, just because like the Brewers Association is going to do everything that they can, but ultimately they're a function of like these breweries, like as an aggregate, you know, like it's not like they have like an independent policing authority that like the Brewers Association can be like, go shut this place down. Or, you know, like the only thing we can do is lean on different breweries to change conduct or to kind of serve as cautionary tales of like, look, like, you know, if you're engaging in this type of activity, like it's not acceptable. But one of the biggest things is like so much of like a lot of the entrenched problems aren't really those overt founders style incidents. And so the Brewers Association would have a lot of difficulty like uprooting like a systemic like failure to promote, like who is like brought, like all of these like micro instances of who's brought out on marketing trips or who's pouring at events, who, like, you know, like all of these like minor things, like the ways in which you court demographically, like who comes to your tap room, you're like your focus on your marketing. And like, these are all things that, like, as much as it is like easy to blame Brewers Association, like as the figurehead, it's like, it's an aggregate of the breweries themselves. And so I'd say like, yeah, you can hold their feet to the fire and hope they'll change. But really the best way would be just create the standard of conduct to be such that every brewer is kind of like, yeah, we're not going to tolerate like our female servers like getting ogled or like getting hollered at or harassed or like getting texted by beer buyer accounts. Like, you know, just all these like minor instances that the Brewers Association isn't going to have a PowerPoint presentation about, like, this guy got drunk and he did these inappropriate things. Like the breweries themselves, like, they'll either end up on Worst Beer Blog or they'll be outed in different ways. I think that like, it's like turning an ice barge. It's just like, it takes a long time because it's just got so much momentum, like to this massive thing that once like you course correct, it'll make sense, but it's not just one Brewers Association jerk of the wheel that's going to flip this thing on its head. It's the culture itself.
Sure. Now I want to chime in on one more thing. You've mentioned Worst Beer Blog a couple of times. And I think, you know, it's always been intriguing to me to follow kind of both of your all's rise, because I think you all both kind of came about around similar times. And I know that there are multiple instances where you all have been confused amongst each other. What is your relationship with Worst Beer Blog? And I guess, is there any sort of like, have you all ever actually like communicated and talked about collaborating on some stuff? I know that you all do very different things.
Yeah. I mean, like there'll be times, like if I have something pointed that I want to post about, I'll check and see if like he's already posted about it or stuff like that, just cause like it's fatiguing to just beat up the same points over and over. And plus people like, get obsessed with like, oh, you got scooped, like DDB scooped you or this or that. like I think we do such different things. I would say that I would classify myself more as like an entertainer. I'm sure that Worst Beer Blog's content is entertaining, but I think like between doing the podcast and comedy and live shows and videos and like just everything that I'm generating like hours and hours of content every week. Almost none of it is like, you know, screenshots or anything like that. And I don't cover beer journalism and I don't cover like things like in that realm so much. Like we talk, I don't even think there's really like a competitive aspect to it. And he's been killing it. And like, I think that the function of like his like base and showing, you know, what occurs, like how much of it is really reaching some of the fans that like are just there for the popcorn and like the shit show. Yeah. I think that could just be a failing of human nature, but, no, I mean, like we talk, there's nothing really that we've had to collaborate on just cause we're in such different zones. Like, sure. You know, I don't know. Sometimes he, like, for example, he shared the screenshots of like the Beer and Racism book. Like that was a collaboration because like I served up this content and it just turned into a disaster. So it's like, yeah, sometimes I'll unintentionally collaborate and end up on his site.
Well, in the spirit of it being GABF week, I'd love to hear some of your favorite beers of the year thus far. I know it's been a weird year in terms of consuming beer, but any standouts that you'd like to give a shout out to, and also any Colorado beers or breweries that you have really enjoyed over the past year?
Yeah, I'll constantly talk about this beer. To the point that locals are like, shut up about it. Because I know Colorado people don't appreciate me blowing the lid off on this one. But Royal Oil, every year that I have Royal Oil, I love it. And every year Colorado locals are like, shut up, you're going to ruin this.
It's funny because even in the comments section of this live broadcast, someone brought up that you would tip the hat to Royal Oil. So I think your base knows you well.
Yeah, so certainly that obviously I'm a big barley wine guy. Like I really enjoyed the collaboration between Southern Grist and Dissolver, Wooden Teeth. That was absolutely phenomenal. And the releases have been so strange that it's kind of weird. You're drinking everything on your own. So you don't have those like sensory factors. Like when somebody tells you about how they went abroad and they had an unpasteurized Pilsner, God, it just tastes different when you're there. You know, like those like types of stories, everything is like organic and just like strictly about like what the beer tastes like, which, kind of is what I've been about all along. And so it's kind of cool to see people focus on this. But yeah, I'm trying to think of off the top of my head. I know I just submitted my list to Craft Beer and Brewing. So I don't want to like retread a lot of the same ground.
Yeah, totally.
Like that, the George Dickel Here Be Monsters, that was amazing. The single barrel, we had that on Malt Couture. Casey continues to kick out a ton of great stuff. I'm not in the family anymore. I'm not in the family, but, but no, they're consistently one of the most gentle, you know, type of softest execution breweries. And God, speaking of, you know, it seems like I'm plugging them because I did a live show there, but, dude, just what Amalgam and Westbound and Down are putting out. Holy shit. Between the Underground Breakfast and all of the, Yeah, the West Coast
Heroes.
Oh my God, those have been like breathing life into just crystal clear, like sea hop driven old school stuff.
Fucking IPA.
And you've got to try their latest one with La Cumbre. I think it's from what I've heard, it's one of the best.
Bought a 4-pack for my dad. Had one. Incredible.
So yeah, Sammy.
Good. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
It was, everything that you wanted. And granted, I mean, those are the beers that I'm drinking right now, but that beer gave me everything that I needed.
That doesn't happen to be at one of our sponsors, does it?
Oh, yeah. I think it is. So great plug for Molly Spirits. Yeah, be sure to go get some Western Conference All-Stars from Westbound and Down. They're cranking out some killer stuff right now. Well, Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to join us for the show today. You've been an inspiration to all of us here at Porch Drinking. We've been a big fan of your work, and it really was impressive to see what you created in the fundraiser this summer. And we'd love to help you in whatever ways that continues to evolve down the line. So thank you so much. Be sure to check out Alex's podcast, Malt Couture. They do a fantastic job with that as well. And be sure to check out Don't Drink Beers. They do killer stuff all day and every day. So thanks again for joining us. Sammy, Corey, thank you again. This has been episode 71 of the Porchcast. And as a reminder, our good friends over at Cerebral Brewing have a pretty rad couple weeks lined up with all the stops. This week they've got Parish Brewing and Southern Grist. They're doing a case where you can go and buy rare beers that you can't typically find here, because despite GABF not taking place, they've still got the celebration going on. So be sure to check out Cerebral Brewing each week for a different lineup of breweries from different regions all across the U.S. Currently, they're in the South. I think they're moving up to Pennsylvania for a couple breweries up there next and ending up in New York. So lots of fun stuff ahead for Cerebral Brewing. Check it out on their website. This has been episode 71 of the Porchcast. We'll check you later.